for this most famous of paintings is none other than the maestro himself. Perhaps the Mona Lisa was Leonardo's sole portrait. Regardless of Mona Lisa's true identity, she illuminates the essential place of paradox in da Vinci's worldview. Sfumato and you. In the past, a high tolerance for uncertainty was a quality to be found only in great geniuses like Leonardo. As change accelerates, we now find that ambiguity multiplies and illusions of certainty become more difficult to maintain. The ability to thrive with ambiguity must become part of our everyday lives. Poise in the face of paradox is a key not only to effectiveness, but to sanity in a rapidly changing world. Rate yourself on a scale of 1 to 10 on tolerance for ambiguity, with 1 representing complete maniacal need for certainty at all times, and 10 representing an enlightened Taoist priest or Leonardo. What behaviors could you change to move up 1 point on the scale? The exercises that follow are designed to help you strengthen your powers of sfumato. To get the most from the exercises, spend some time with the self-assessment questions first. Sfumato, self-assessment. I am comfortable with ambiguity. I am attuned to the rhythms of my intuition. I thrive with change. I see the humor in life every day. I have a tendency to jump to conclusions. I enjoy riddles, puzzles, and puns. I usually know when I am feeling anxious. I spend sufficient time on my own. I trust my gut. I can comfortably hold contradictory ideas in my mind. I delight in paradox and am sensitive to irony. I appreciate the importance of conflict in inspiring creativity. Sfumato, application and exercises. Curiosita equals uncertainty. Return to your list of your 10 most important life questions from the Curiosita chapter. Which ones cause you the greatest sense of uncertainty or ambivalence? Are there paradoxes at the heart of any of these questions? Working in your notebook, try your hand at some abstract art. Sketch the feeling of uncertainty generated by a particular question from your Curiosita list. Then experiment with gestures and perhaps an improvisational dance that express that feeling. If you are not sure what to do, then you have got the idea. What music would you choose to accompany your ambiguity dance? Make friends with ambiguity. In your notebook, list and briefly describe 3 situations from your life, past or present, where ambiguity reigns. You might, for example, remember waiting to hear if you were accepted at the college of your choice, or wondering about the possibility of downsizing in your organization, or considering the future of a significant relationship. Describe the feeling of ambiguity. Where in your body do you experience it? If ambiguity had a shape, a color, a sound, a taste, a smell, what would they be? How do you respond to feelings of ambiguity? How are ambiguity and anxiety related? Observe anxiety. For many people, ambiguity equals anxiety, but most people, unless they have worked intensively with a good psychotherapist, do not know when they are anxious. They react to anxiety with some form of automatic avoidance behavior, such as talking excessively, pouring a drink, reaching for a cigarette, or having an obsessive fantasy. To thrive with uncertainty and ambiguity, we must learn, first of all, to know when we are anxious. As we become conscious of our anxiety, we can learn to accept it, experience it, and free ourselves from limiting compulsions of thought and action. Describe the feeling of anxiety. Are there different types of anxiety? Where in your body do you experience anxiety? If anxiety had a shape, a color, a sound, a taste, a smell, what would they be? How do you respond to feelings of anxiety? Make anxiety a theme for a day. Record your observations in your notebook. Monitor intolerance for ambiguity. Count the number of times per day that you use an absolute such as totally, always, certainly, must, never, and absolutely. Note the way you close conversations. Do you usually end with a statement or a question? Cultivate confusion endurance. The Sfumato principle touches the essence of being. Just as day follows night, our capacity for joy is born in sorrow. We are each the center of a unique and special universe and totally insignificant specks of cosmic dust. Of all the polarities, none is more daunting than life and death. The shadow of death gives life its potential for meaning. You can develop your Da Vincian powers by nurturing confusion endurance, sharpening your senses in the face of paradox, and embracing creative tension. Practice the contemplation exercise with any of the following paradoxes. Joy and sorrow. Think of the saddest moments of your life. Which moments were most joyful? What is the relationship between these states? Do you ever feel joy and sorrow simultaneously? Leonardo once wrote, "The highest happiness becomes the cause of unhappiness." Do you agree? Is the opposite true? Intimacy and independence. In your closest relationships, what is the connection between intimacy and independence? Can you have one without the other? Does this connection ever inspire anxiety? Strength and weakness. List at least three of your strengths as a person. List three or more of your weaknesses. How are the qualities in your lists related? Good and evil. Is it possible to be good without acknowledging and understanding one's own impulses toward evil? What Jung called the shadow. What happens when people are unconscious of or deny the shadow? How can you recognize and accept your own prejudice, hate, anger, jealousy, envy, greed, pride, and sloth without acting them out? Change and constancy. Note three of the most significant changes you have observed in your lifetime. Note three things that remain constant. Is the idea that the more things change, the more they remain the same, a valid aphorism or a vapid cliché? Here are some of the maestro's thoughts on the issue. Constancy may be symbolized by the phoenix, which, knowing that by nature it must be resuscitated, has the constancy to endure the burning flames which consume it, and then it rises anew. Humility and pride. Think of the proudest moments of your life. Remember the times you felt most humble. Aim to recreate your most profound feelings of genuine humility and true pride. How are these feelings different? Are there any unexpected similarities between humility and pride? Are these qualities opposites? Goals and process. Think of an important goal that you have accomplished. Describe the process you followed in achieving that goal. Have you ever achieved a success without experiencing fulfillment? How do goal and process, doing and being, relate? Does the end justify the means? To live a successful and fulfilling life, must one, A, be 100% committed to achieving clearly defined goals, B, recognize that the process of living every day, the daily quality of life, is of greatest importance, or C, both A and B? Life and death. Make up your own exercise for this one. Leonardo on Life and Death. Behold now the hope or desire of going back to one's own country or returning to primal chaos, like that of the moth to the light, of the man who with perpetual longing always looks forward with joy to each new spring and each new summer, deeming that the things he longs for are too slow in coming. And who does not perceive that he is longing for his own destruction? But this longing is, in its quintessence, the spirit of the elements, which, finding itself imprisoned within the life of the human body, desires continually to return to its source. And I have you know that this same longing is in its quintessence inherent in nature. Meditate on Mona. Serge Bramley refers to a Chinese poet of the Song Dynasty who observed that the three most wasteful and disturbing things in the world were to witness poorly educated youths, mishandling of fine tea, and great art go unappreciated. Leonardo's Mona Lisa is so familiar that it is rarely seen. Sit with Mona for a while. Wait for your analytical mind to calm down and breathe in her essence. Note your responses. When you visit Paris, go to the Louvre when it opens at 9 a.m. and head straight for a relatively private audience with the real Mona. Embody Mona's smile. Experiment with embodying Mona's facial expression, especially the famous smile. Note how you feel. Responses from people who have tried this exercise include, I feel like my mind is in two places at once. When I smile like that, I feel freer inside. It makes me feel like one of the cognoscenti. I felt an immediate transformation. Everything was suddenly completely different. Now go back to the most anxiety-producing questions from your curiosità list. Only this time, when you think about each question, embody Mona's smile. Does your thinking change when you look from Mona's perspective? Record your observations in your notebook. The eyes have the luster and moisture always seen in living people, while around them are the lashes and all the reddish tones which cannot be produced without the greatest care. The eyebrows could not be more natural. The nose seems lifelike with its beautiful pink and tender nostrils. The mouth, with its opening joining the red of the lips to the flesh of the face, seems to be real flesh rather than paint. Anyone who looked very attentively at the hollow of her throat would see her pulse beating. Giorgio Vasari on viewing the Mona Lisa. Incubation and intuition. Great musicians claim that their art comes to life in the spaces between notes. Master sculptors point to the space around their work as the secret of its power. Similarly, the spaces between your conscious efforts provide a key to creative living and problem-solving. These spaces allow perceptions, ideas, and feelings to incubate. When Leonardo was working on the Last Supper, he spent many days on the scaffold, painting from dawn until dusk. Then, without warning, he would take a break. The prior of Santa Maria delle Grazie, who contracted for his services, was not amused. As Vasari noted, the prior of the church entreated Leonardo, with tiresome persistence, to complete the work, since it seemed strange to him to see how Leonardo sometimes passed half a day at a time lost in thought, and he would have preferred Leonardo, just like the laborers hoeing in the garden, never to have laid down his brush. Vasari explains that the prior complained to the Duke, who questioned Leonardo about his working habits. He tells us that Leonardo persuaded the Duke that the greatest geniuses sometimes accomplish more when they work less. Clearly, Leonardo didn't underestimate his stature, yet pride in his abilities and confidence in the rhythms of incubation were balanced with humility and delightful humor. Vasari relates that the maestro explained to the Duke that he still had two faces to complete, Christ and Judas. The face of Christ, which ultimately was to remain unfinished, was a challenge that Leonardo felt to be beyond his powers, for he was unwilling to seek a model on earth and unable to presume that his imagination could conceive of the beauty and celestial grace required of the divinity incarnate. As for the face of Judas, Leonardo explained to the Duke that it would be a great challenge to find a model for one so wicked as to betray his Lord, the Creator of the world. Nonetheless, he would search for a model for this second face, but if in the end he could not find anything better, there was always the head of the prior. Although your boss may not accept the idea that the greatest geniuses sometimes accomplish more when they work less, the art of incubation is nevertheless essential to actualizing your creative potential. Almost everyone has experienced sleeping on a problem and awakening with a solution. But incubation is most effective when you alternate, as Leonardo did, between periods of intense, focused work and rest. Without periods of intense, focused work, there is nothing to be incubated. Discovering and learning to trust your incubatory rhythms is a simple secret of accessing your intuition and creativity. Sometimes incubation yields an obvious insight, or aha. But frequently, the fruits of unconscious work are subtle and easy to overlook. The muses demand attention to the delicate nuances of thought, listening for the faint whispers of shy inner voices. Neuroscientists estimate that your unconscious database outweighs the conscious on an order exceeding 10 million to 1. This database is the source of your creative potential. In other words, a part of you is much smarter than you are. The wisest people regularly consult that smarter part. You can, too, by making space for incubation. Sfumato for parents. Young children are not ready to deal with the profound paradoxes of life. They do, however, love riddles and mysteries. Nurture sfumato with games, puzzles, and stories. For example, tell your kids the same bedtime stories, but make up different endings each time. In addition to stimulating your own imaginative powers, you will be encouraging their delight in the unknown. Take time for solitude and relaxation. Where are you when you get your best ideas? Over the past 20 years, I've asked thousands of people this question. The most frequent answers: resting in bed, walking in nature, listening to music while driving in my car, and relaxing in the shower or bath. Almost no one claims to get their best ideas at work. What happens when you walk in the woods, rest in bed, or luxuriate in the shower that isn't happening in the workplace? Solitude and relaxation. Most people experience their breakthrough ideas when they are relaxed and by themselves. Although Da Vinci loved exchanging ideas with others, he knew that his most creative insights came when he was alone. He wrote, "The painter must be solitary, for if you are alone, you are completely yourself. But if you are accompanied by a single companion, you are half yourself." Nurture sfumato by taking time for solitude. Take a little time at least once or twice a week to go for a walk or just sit quietly by yourself. Dr. Candace Pert, author of Molecules of Emotion, on the mind of your body. Your brain is extremely well integrated with the rest of your body at a molecular level, so much so that the term mobile brain is an apt description of the psychosomatic network through which intelligent information travels from one system to another. Pert adds, "Every second, a massive information exchange is occurring in your body. Imagine each of these messenger systems possessing a specific tone, humming a signature tune, rising and falling, waxing and waning, binding and unbinding. Intuition is the art of listening, with an inner ear, to the rhythms and melodies of your own body music." Take a little relaxation. Many of us spend our days working hard in a focused, left-brained fashion. We sometimes get so involved in projects that we begin to lose perspective. You can increase your enjoyment and effectiveness when working or studying by taking breaks every hour or so. Modern psychological research shows that when you study or work for an hour and then take a complete break for 10 minutes, your recall for the material you have been working on is higher at the end of the 10-minute break than it was at the end of the hour. Psychologists call this phenomenon the reminiscence effect. In his treatise on painting, Da Vinci counseled, "It is well that you should often leave off work and take a little relaxation, because when you come back to it, you are a better judge." Follow the maestro's advice and build the occasional 10-minute brain break into your busy schedule. Try listening to jazz or classical music, creative doodling, meditation, or stretching exercises to promote relaxation and incubation. In addition to hourly breaks, be sure to enjoy some kind of weekly Sabbath and to take a true vacation every year. Trust your gut. Bring more attention to your everyday hunches and intuitions. Try writing them down in your notebook and then checking your accuracy. By monitoring your daily intuitions, you hone their accuracy. Cultivating an accurate, reliable inner guidance system requires listening to your body. Comments such as, "My gut tells me otherwise. I just know it in my bones. I can feel it in the pit of my stomach, and I know in my heart of hearts that it must be true," reflect the body-centered nature of intuition. When you take time for solitude, walking in nature, driving in your car, or just lying in bed, remember to listen to your bones and check in with your heart of hearts. Try the following exquisitely simple exercise one or two times every day for accessing the subtle nuances of your intuition. Enjoy a few deep exhalations, soften your belly, be receptive. Sfumato at work. In the 1980s, the American Management Association published a study concluding that the most successful managers were distinguished by high tolerance for ambiguity and intuitive decision-making skill. Now, as the pace of change accelerates, tolerance for ambiguity is no longer sufficient. Ambiguity must be embraced and enjoyed. In The Logic of Intuitive Decision-Making, Professor Weston Augur reported his discovery, made through extensive interviews, that senior executives overwhelmingly pointed to a failure to heed their own intuition as the prime cause of their worst decisions. As we begin the 21st century, information threatens to overwhelm us with sheer volume. Intuition is more important than ever. The bottom line, embrace ambiguity and trust your gut. Arte Scienza. The development of the balance between science and art, logic and imagination. Whole brain thinking. Are you familiar with the research into the left and right hemispheres of the cerebral cortex? If so, do you know your brain dominance profile? In other words, are you a more artistic, intuitive right hemisphere thinker, or do you feel more comfortable with the step-by-step logic of the left? The terms left-brained and right-brained came into popular parlance through the Nobel Prize-winning research of Professor Roger Sperry. Sperry discovered that in most cases, the left hemisphere of the cerebral cortex processes logical, analytical thinking, while the right hemisphere processes imaginative, big-picture thinking. Although our schools often pay lip service to the idea of the balanced Renaissance individual, in practice we suffer from a pandemic of half-witted thinking. In the words of Professor Sperry, our education system, as well as science in general, tends to neglect the nonverbal form of intellect. What it comes down to is that modern society discriminates against the right hemisphere. The result is that individuals with left hemisphere dominance tend to do well in school, but often fail to develop their creative capacities. While individuals who are right hemisphere dominant often feel guilty for the way they think and are frequently mislabeled as learning disabled. Seekers of balance are inevitably drawn to a study of Leonardo. A significant part of our fascination with him is his stature as the supreme whole-brain thinker. Art historian Kenneth Clark begins his essay on the relationship between Leonardo's science and art by emphasizing the interdependence of the disciplines. It is usual to treat Leonardo as a scientist and Leonardo as a painter in separate studies, and no doubt the difficulties in following his mechanical and scientific investigations make this a prudent course. Nevertheless, it is not completely satisfactory, because in the end, the history of art cannot be properly understood without some reference to the history of science. In both, we are studying the symbols by which man affirms his mental scheme, and these symbols, be they pictorial or mathematical, a fable or a formula, will reflect the same changes. Historian of science George Sarton reflects from a different perspective but reaches similar conclusions. Since the growth of knowledge is the core of progress, the history of science ought to be the core of general history. Yet the main problems of life cannot be solved by men of science alone or by artists and humanists. We need the cooperation of them all. Science is always indispensable, but never sufficient. We are hungry for beauty, and where charity is lacking, nothing else is of any avail. Sartan adds, Leonardo's outstanding merit is to have shown by his own example that the pursuit of beauty and the pursuit of truth are not incompatible. So, was Leonardo a scientist who studied art, or an artist who studied science? Clearly, he was both. His scientific studies of rocks, plants, flight, flowing water, and human anatomy, for example, are expressed in beautiful, evocative, expressive works of art, not dry technical drawings. At the same time, the plans for his paintings and sculptures are exquisitely detailed, painstakingly analytical, and mathematically precise. As Jacob Bernofsky, author of The Ascent of Man, comments, Leonardo took an artist's vision into science. He understood that science, as much as painting, has to find the design of nature in her detail. He gave science what is most needed, the artist's sense that the detail of nature is significant. Until science had this sense, no one could care, or could think that it mattered, how fast two unequal masses fall and whether the orbits of planets are accurately circles or ellipses. For Leonardo, art and science were indivisible. In his treatise on painting, he cautions potential adepts. Those who become enamored of the art, without having previously applied to the diligent study of the scientific part of it, may be compared to mariners who put to sea in a ship without rudder or compass, and therefore cannot be certain of arriving at the wished-for port. Leonardo emphasized, for example, that the ability of the artist to express the beauty of the human form is predicated on a profound study of the science of anatomy. Lacking an appreciation born of a detailed analysis of bone structure and muscular relationships, the would-be artist was liable to draw wooden and graceless nudes that seem rather as if you were looking at a stack of nuts than a human form, or a bundle of radishes rather than the muscles. He also noted, be sure you know the structure of all you wish to depict. Yet Kenneth Clark contends that Leonardo's science was predicated on his art. It is often said that Leonardo drew so well because he knew about things. It is truer to say that he knew about things because he drew so well. While championing rigor, one of his mottos was ostinate rigore, obstinate rigor, attention to detail, logic, mathematics, and intense practical analysis, Leonardo also urged his students to awaken the power of imagination in what was then an unprecedented way. Offering what he called a new and speculative idea, which, although it may seem trivial and almost laughable, is nonetheless of great value in quickening the spirit of invention. He urged students to stare at stones, smoke, embers, clouds, and mud, and cultivate their ability to see in these mundane forms the likeness of divine landscapes and an infinity of things. Such insight, he writes, comes about as it does with the sound of bells, in whose clanging you may discover every name and word that you can imagine. This instruction represents more than just advice to stimulate an artist's imagination. It is a breakthrough in the evolution of human thought. Da Vinci gave birth to a tradition that resulted in the modern discipline of brainstorming. Prior to Da Vinci, the concept of creative thinking as an intellectual discipline didn't exist. The role of the artist in Leonardo's time. At the time of Leonardo's birth, the artist was an anonymous craftsman with the social status of a laborer. Artists worked in a setting more like a factory than a modern studio and were paid wages by the hour. Most of their products were collaborative efforts that remained unsigned. In pre-Renaissance Europe, all creativity was vested in the divine, and the idea of human as creator was blasphemous. In the course of Leonardo's lifetime, the artist's role transformed dramatically. Artists began to undertake work based on their own interests rather than the specific dictates of a patron. They began to sign their paintings and to write autobiographies, and biographies were written about them. Raphael, Titian, and Michelangelo became superstars in their own time, wealthy, respected, venerated. The seeds of this remarkable transformation were planted by Leonardo's precursor, Leon Battista Alberti, in whose day arithmetic, geometry, astronomy, music, grammar, logic, and rhetoric were accepted among the intellectual elite as the noble disciplines, the foundations of knowledge. Painting was not included, but Alberti saw that the emerging mathematically based disciplines of proportion and perspective could provide the common ground for painting and the noble disciplines. Leonardo seized this idea and extended it. His formulation of painting as a science placed his beloved practice of knowing how to see first among the liberal arts. Da Vinci's urgings to go straight to nature, to be an original, what he called an inventore, served to transform not only the role of the artist, but the very concept of genius. Arte Scienza at Work. Ned Herrmann, founder of the Whole Brain Corporation, developed a test to determine hemispheric dominance. In his workshops, Herrmann has been known to take those who test out as ultra-left and ultra-right and give them a special assignment. They are allowed 2 hours to complete it. The ultra-left-brained group returns exactly on time, having completed a typewritten report, with all the I's dotted and T's crossed. Beautifully organized, their report is painfully boring and uninspired. The ultra-right hemisphere group involves itself in a philosophical debate on the meaning of the assignment. They return at different times with ideas scratched on scrap paper, disorganized, and generally useless. The two groups are then combined into one, with a facilitator guiding them as they work together on another task. They return on time with a balanced, organized, creative product. The lesson? Effectiveness demands the creation of balanced brain teams. More often than not, however, individuals tend to polarize by hemispheric style. The left brain dominants in the finance department gather by their coffee machine, look over at the right-brained marketing people and think, "Those flaky dreamers have their heads in the clouds. They don't understand the bottom line like we do." Meanwhile, at the right-brained water cooler, the right-brainers are eyeing the left-brainers and thinking, "What tiny minds those bean counters have. They don't see the whole picture like we do." Individuals often fall into a similar trap internally. Left-brainers think, "I'm sorry, I'm left-brained. I can't possibly be creative or imaginative." And right-brainers make the mistake of programming themselves, "Well, I'm right-brained. I can't possibly come to meetings on time." Since 1978, I've worked with thousands of managers at all levels. Some are analytical, serious, thorough planners. Others are intuitive, playful, spontaneous improvisers. The very best are those who balance analysis and intuition, seriousness and play, planning and improvisation. Arte and Scienza. Arte Scienza and you. Study the science of art and the Art of Science, Leonardo da Vinci. While all the principles in this book can help you balance your hemispheres and awaken your latent da Vincian capabilities, you can concentrate on that balance by using one simple, tremendously powerful method for cultivating a synergy between arte and scienza in your everyday thinking, planning, and problem-solving. The method is called mind mapping. Mind mapping is a whole-brain method for generating and organizing ideas, originated by Tony Buzan and largely inspired by Da Vinci's approach to note-taking. You can use mind mapping for personal goal-setting, daily planning, and interpersonal problem-solving. It can help you at work, with your kids, or with any pursuit. The most marvelous application of mind mapping, however, is that through regular practice, it trains you to be a more balanced thinker, a la Leonardo. Let's set the stage for learning to mind map by considering the method that most of us learned for generating and organizing ideas, the outline. The traditional outline begins with Roman numeral 1. Have you ever spent an inordinate amount of time waiting for idea Roman numeral 1? Perhaps you finally get it after 20 minutes or so, and continue your outline down to point 3D, when you realize that point 3D should be point 2B. You cross it out and draw an arrow. Now your outline is getting messy. And we all know that outlines must be neat. Frustrated, you start to doodle or daydream. Your repressed right hemisphere is attempting to express itself, but doodling makes your outline even messier. And you feel guilty for daydreaming. Beset and beleaguered by this internecine cortical strife, you crumple up your paper and try to begin again. Although valuable as a tool for presenting ideas in a formal, orderly fashion, outlining is useful only after the real thinking has been done. If you try to generate your ideas by outlining, you will find that it slows you down and stifles your freedom of thought. It is just plain illogical to try to organize your ideas before you've generated them. Moreover, outlining and other linear note-making systems exclude your brain's capacity for color, dimension, synthesis, rhythm, and image. By imposing one color and one form, outlining guarantees monotony. Outlining uses only half of your mind, and half a mind is a terrible thing to waste. Mind mapping frees you from the tyranny of premature organization, which stifles your generation of ideas. Mind mapping liberates your conceptual powers by balancing generation and organization while encouraging the full range of mental expression. Think about the last book you read or the last seminar you attended. Imagine that you have to write a report on that book or seminar. Begin recalling the information. As you do, observe the process of your mind at work. Does your mind work by constructing whole paragraphs or by presenting ordered outlines to your mind's eye? Probably not. Chances are that impressions, keywords, and images float into mind, one associating with the next. Mind mapping is a method for continuing this natural thinking process on paper. Leonardo urged artists and scientists to go straight to nature in the search for knowledge and understanding. If you contemplate the structure of a tree or a plant like the Star of Bethlehem, you can see that it is a network of life, expanding in all directions from its trunk or stem. Take a helicopter ride over a major city. It is a sprawling structure of interconnecting centers and pathways, main arteries connecting with side roads, our water table, global telecommunication system, and solar system are similarly linked networks. The structure of communication in nature is nonlinear and self-organizing. It works through networks and systems. Perhaps the most amazing natural system of all is right inside your skull. The basic structural unit of brain function is the neuron. Each of our billions of neurons branches out from a center called the nucleus. Each branch or dendrite, from dendron meaning tree, is covered with little nodes called dendritic spines. As we think, electrochemical information jumps across the tiny gap between spines. This junction is called a synapse. Our thinking is a function of a vast network of synaptic patterns. A mind map is a graphic expression of these natural patterns of the brain. It should not be too surprising, therefore, that the note-taking styles of many of history's great brains, such as Charles Darwin, Michelangelo, Mark Twain, and, of course, Leonardo da Vinci, features branching, organic structure, complemented by lots of sketches, creative doodles, and key words. How right or left-brained are you? Before you set out to learn to mind-map your way to whole-brain thinking, spend a few minutes reflecting on your own hemispheric proclivities. Which statements apply to you? Which list you are about to hear describes you best? The first list is a classic description of someone who is more left-brained. The second list contains characteristics associated with a more right-brained person. Of course, most people are more complex than this simple model suggests. Nevertheless, the metaphor of left and right is a useful tool for thinking about balance. Whatever your hemispheric tendencies happen to be, the key to fulfilling your full potential is the continuing discovery of balance. Arta Scienza, Self-Assessment, List 1. I like details. I'm almost always on time. I am skilled at math. I rely on logic. I write clearly. Friends describe me as very articulate. Analysis is one of my strengths. I am organized and disciplined. I like lists. I read a book starting at page 1 and go through in order. List 2. I am highly imaginative. I am good at brainstorming. I often say or do the unexpected. I love to doodle. In school, I was better at geometry than algebra. I read a book by skipping around. I prefer to look at the big picture and leave the details to someone else. I often lose track of time. I rely on intuition. Arte Scienza, Applications and Exercises. Learn the rules of mind mapping. At the end of the treatise on painting, Leonardo wrote, "These rules are intended to help you to a free and good judgment, for good judgment proceeds from good understanding, and good understanding comes from reason trained by good rules, and good rules are the children of sound experience, which is the common mother of all the sciences and arts." The rules of mind mapping are intended to help you to a free and good judgment. They are the children of sound experience, having been extensively tested and refined over the past 30 years. All you need to begin mind mapping is a topic, a few colored pens, and a large sheet of paper. Follow these rules. 1. Begin your mind map with a symbol or a picture, representing your topic, at the center of your page. Starting at the center opens your mind to a full 360 degrees of association. Pictures and symbols are much easier to remember than words and enhance your ability to think creatively about your subject. 2. Write down key words. Key words are the information-rich nuggets of recall and creative association. 3. Connect the key words with lines radiating from your central image. By linking words with lines, branches, you'll show clearly how one keyword relates to another. 4. Print your keywords. Printing is easier to read and remember than writing. 5. Print one keyword per line. By doing this, you free yourself to discover the maximum number of creative associations for each keyword. The discipline of one word per line also trains you to focus on the most appropriate keyword, enhancing the precision of your thought and minimizing clutter. 6. Print your keywords on the lines and make the length of the word the same as the line it is on. This maximizes clarity of association and encourages economy of space. 7. Use colors, pictures, dimension, and codes for greater association and emphasis. Highlight important points and illustrate relationships between different branches of your mind map. You might, for instance, prioritize your main points through color coding, highlighting in yellow the most important points, using blue for secondary points, and so forth. Pictures and images, preferably in vivid color, should be used wherever possible. They stimulate your creative association and greatly enhance your memory. Make your own mind map. As you experiment with mind mapping, its advantages will become increasingly obvious. Mind mapping allows you to start quickly and generate more ideas in less time. You'll find that thinking, working, and problem-solving become a lot more fun. All outlines tend to look the same, but every mind map is different. Perhaps the greatest advantage of mind mapping is that by nurturing your unique, individual self-expression, it guides you to discover your own originality. Regular practice of mind mapping will help you become an inventore. This simple mind mapping exercise will help you get started. 1. Begin with a large sheet of blank white paper and 6 or more colored pens. You may want to use phosphorescent highlighters for extra color. Of course, one pen or pencil and a small sheet of paper will work in a pinch. Although you can make mind maps on the backs of matchbooks, in the palm of your hand, or on post-it notes, it's best to use a big sheet of paper. Flip chart size is recommended. The bigger the paper, the greater the freedom to express your associations. Place the paper horizontally in front of you. A horizontal disposition makes it easier for you to keep all your keywords upright and easy to read. 2. Let's say that the topic for this mind map is the Renaissance. Start your mind map by drawing a representative image in the middle of the paper. Draw it as vividly as you can, using more than one color. Have fun, and don't worry about the accuracy of your drawing. 3. Now print keywords or draw images on lines radiating out from your central image. Remember to print on the lines, one keyword or image per line, and keep the lines connected. Generating ideas in keyword form is easy. For example, as you think about the Renaissance, one keyword might be art, which might trigger other keyword associations like painting, sculpture, architecture. Another key branch could be inventions, triggering associations such as printing, clock, pencil. Other main branches might include people, politics, religion, parallels. If you feel stuck, choose any keyword on your mind map and immediately print your first association with that word, even if it seems ridiculous or irrelevant. Keep your associations flowing, and don't worry about making sure that every word is right. 4. When you feel you have generated enough material through free association, look at the result. All your ideas spread across one page. As you examine your mind map, you will see relationships that help you organize and integrate your ideas. Look for words that appear repeatedly throughout the map. They often suggest major themes. 5. Connect related parts of your mind map with arrows, codes, and colors. Eliminate elements that seem extraneous. Pare your mind map down to just the ideas you need for your purpose. Then put them in sequence if necessary. This can be accomplished with numbers or by redrawing the mind map in clockwise order. How do you know that your mind map is finished? Theoretically, a mind map never ends. As Da Vinci emphasized, everything is connected to everything else. If you had the time, energy, inclination, enough colored pens, and a big enough piece of paper, you could go on linking all your knowledge and ultimately all human knowledge. Of course, if you are planning a speech or studying for an examination, you probably don't have time to link all human knowledge. The simple answer is that your mind map is finished when the information you have generated meets your objectives for the task at hand. Some tips for keeping your mind map neat, easy, and organized. Keep your central image in the center of the page and limit its size. Use angled and curved lines as necessary to keep all your keywords upright and easy to read. Use just one word per line and be sure to print the keywords. Make the lines a bit thicker at their origin and print your letters at least 1/4 inch in height so they are easy to read. You can print some letters even larger for emphasis. Make each word the same size as the line underneath it. This saves space and allows you to see connections more clearly. If possible, use large sheets of paper. This helps to avoid crowding and encourages you to think big. Do not be concerned if your first draft seems disorganized. You can make a second or third draft for further clarification. Practice your mind mapping skills. Although mind mapping is an invaluable tool for simplifying complex tasks such as strategic planning, presentation preparation, meeting management, test preparation, and systems analysis, it is probably best to make your first few mind maps on relatively simple, lighthearted subjects. Choose one of the following topics to begin practicing your mind mapping skill solo. Take about 20 minutes for this first practice map. Mind map your next day off. Begin with a simple drawing that represents a free day, e.g., a smiling sun, a calendar page. Print keywords and draw images that express some things you might like to do on your next day off. Remember to put keywords and images on lines radiating out from your central symbol. Mind map your dream vacation. Explore the delightful fantasy of a dream vacation using a mind map. Start with a symbol of your paradise in the center, e.g., ocean waves, snow-covered mountains, the Eiffel Tower, and then branch out with keywords and images that represent the elements of your ideal holiday. Mind map a perfect evening for a friend. Use a mind map to explore the design of a perfect evening for someone you love. Start with an image in the center that represents your friend. Then, using keywords or images, branch out with all your thoughts for your friend's happiness. Remember, let your mind work by association instead of trying to put things down in order. Just generate ideas for your friend's delight. Then, after you have come up with a multitude of possibilities, you can go back and put them in order. Review your mind map of your day off, dream vacation, or perfect evening. Check your mind map to see how well you followed the rules. Did you create vivid, multicolored images? Did you remember to use just one word per line? Did you print your keywords? Did you keep your lines connected? If you departed from the rules, redo your map correctly. As you can see, there are many possible uses of mind mapping. The two final exercises in this chapter guide you to use this thinking tool in ways that are particularly inspired by the maestro. Make a mind mapping mind map. Okay, now that you are warmed up, try making a mind map on all possible uses of mind mapping. Start with an image in the center of the page that represents the concept of mind mapping for you. Then branch out, putting printed keywords or images on connected lines. Aim to generate at least 20 specific possible applications of mind mapping in your personal and professional life. After you have completed your mind map, highlight what you think might be the most valuable applications. Make a memory mind map. Leonardo's incredible ability to learn and create was predicated on his cultivation of memory, what he called learning by heart. After careful observations from multiple perspectives, Leonardo drew a visual image of his subject. Then, late at night or early in the morning, as he lay in bed, he would review and vivify the image in his mind's eye. Then he compared his mental image to his best drawing until he could hold the perfect image in his mind. Mind mapping is a tremendously powerful tool for learning things by heart. Try the following exercise, based on Leonardo's method, for committing something to memory. Think of something you would like to remember, perhaps the contents of a book you particularly enjoy, a presentation you plan to give, or all the material for a final exam at school or in college. Make a comprehensive mind map of your subject, emphasizing vivid images of your most important points. You may, depending on the volume and complexity of your material, need to do multiple drafts to organize, integrate, and clearly express your subject. When you complete your master mind map, put it aside. Take a blank sheet of paper and, without referring back to the original, attempt to recreate your master map from memory. Do this until you can recreate your original in detail. When you are resting in bed, picture your master map in your mind's eye. Practice visualizing until your mental image matches your master map. Now give your presentation or take your test with perfect recall of your material. Make a creativity mind map. Mind mapping is a wonderful tool for awakening your creativity and, in Leonardo's words, quickening the spirit of invention. Think of an idea you would like to explore or a question or challenge that requires some fresh thinking. Get a large sheet of blank paper and in the center draw an abstract image of your topic. Now, just as the maestro suggested free associating in response to certain walls stained with damp or at stones of uneven color, free associate with your abstract image, recording your associations on the branches of your map. If you let your mind go, you will, in the maestro's words, be able to see an infinity of things which you will be able to reduce to their complete and proper forms. If you think of an idea that seems off the wall, put it in your mind map and keep going. Absurd and unusual associations often lead to creative breakthroughs. Remember that even the greatest genius of all time was concerned that his new and speculative idea may seem trivial and almost laughable, but he did not let that stop him, and neither should you. After you have generated an abundance, if not an infinity, of associations, take a break for incubation. Then come back to your mind map and generate another wave of associations. After another break, review the big picture of your associations, looking for connections and emerging themes. Next, reduce them to their complete and proper forms. In other words, pare your map down to express your most cogent insights. Reorder the branches to reflect a new organization of your thoughts. After applying the mind map method of learning by heart, a 12-year-old boy from Soweto, South Africa wrote, "Before, I did not think I was very smart. Now I know I have a wonderful brain. Now my school is much easier." A manager from a Japanese computer company used mind mapping to generate ideas for a strategic plan and wrote, "Thank you very much, for finally you wake up my brain." A chemical engineer from a Fortune 500 company used this approach to create a new patentable invention. The poet laureate of Great Britain uses it to incubate new poems. You can use it, too, for strengthening your memory, balancing your brain, and quickening your spirit of invention. Arte Scienza for Parents. Many of my clients and friends with more than one child report that their kids have different brain styles and that if they are not careful, they will tend to pass on the prejudices of their own dominant mode. As a left-dominant parent commented, "You know, I've been a fool. I have two kids. One is just like me, very good at math and figures, disciplined and focused. My other kid is totally different. A real dreamer, very artistic, but all over the place. Last night I realized that I have been discriminating against my more right-brain child. If I was more open to him and encouraged him to share his way of looking at things with his brother and me, then we would all be better off." Just as we build balanced brain teams in the workplace, it is also important to do so at home. Many parents unwittingly pass on their cortical prejudices to their children. Support your kids in developing the skills of arte and scienza together. If your child shows a preference for right-brain thinking, tackle history lessons by acting out scenes from the past. Approach mathematics by writing out theorems and equations in bold colors. Help your child be on time by making a color-coded, picture-filled calendar. If your child's orientation is more left-brained, help her to develop balance by emphasizing art, drama, and music appreciation. Whatever your child's brain dominance, she will become more balanced if you encourage her to use mind maps. Focus especially on nurturing your child's ability to learn by heart by making memory mind maps of schoolwork. Corporalità, the cultivation of grace, ambidexterity, fitness, and poise. Handsome and with a splendid physique, he seemed a model of human perfection. Goethe, On Da Vinci. What is your image of the body type of a genius? Did you grow up as I did with the stereotype of the skinny, four-eyed brainiac nerd? It's amazing how many people associate high intelligence with physical ineptitude. With a few exceptions, the great geniuses of history were gifted with remarkable physical energy and aptitude, none more so than Da Vinci. Leonardo's extraordinary physical gifts complemented his intellectual and artistic genius. Vasari extols his great physical beauty and more than infinite grace in every action. Among the citizens of Florence, Leonardo was renowned for his poise, grace, and athleticism. His skill as an equestrian was of a very high level, and his strength was legendary. Witnesses describe Leonardo stopping horses at full gallop by catching their reins and bending horseshoes and door knockers with his bare hands. As Vasari records, his great physical strength could check any violent outburst. With his right hand, he could bend the iron ring of a door knocker or a horseshoe as if it were made of lead. Vasari adds, his great personal strength was joined to dexterity. A number of scholars have suggested that Leonardo's passion for anatomy was a reflection of his own extraordinary physique. Dr. Kenneth Keel, author of Leonardo da Vinci, The Anatomist, refers to him as a unique genetic mutation and emphasizes that his approach to the anatomy of the human body was significantly